Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be listening to some music and talking to the folks from Sabor, which is a local band that plays Cuban music. I'd like to welcome now Mary Hunt Kallenberg. She's an art historian. She's co-owner of the Thai Textile Arts Gallery here in Santa Fe. She's co-editor of the new spectacular book, 5 Centuries of Indonesian Textiles. And she will be speaking this Sunday, the 21st of November at 3:30 at the Inn and Spa at Loreto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. It's part of their Meet the Authors series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, how did you enter the world of textiles, and specifically Indonesian textiles?
Well, I entered the world of textiles as a child, just having discovered textiles in my parents' attic, and became so enamored of them that it just stuck with me as an entire career.
Isn't that amazing?
It is
amazing.
You find
a box of silk ribbons and your life path is set.
I know. And if there are other people whose sort of direction is established very early, but I don't know whether it's a common thing or not, but definitely was in my case. And Indonesia, which I discuss in the book, was because of a letter that came from one of the first authors of books on Indonesian textiles, who was a dealer in Holland, and he offered a group of very interesting textiles to the Textile Museum in Washington, where I was my first job as a curator. And I was so taken by one of these textiles, and the figure in the textile, I just was like this hook went into my heart. And I decided whenever I could, I would pursue that area of study. And so I kept it in my mind. And a year or so later, I moved to head the textile department at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And by some coincidence, my cousin, who was raised here in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, was head of the American Express office in Indonesia. So the path continued to pull me in that direction.
And in the course of now, what, 3 decades, more than 3 decades of doing this, you have finally come out with this incredibly richly illustrated and lots of different essays in this book. And one of the things that's, you know, we look at textiles, we Americans, let's say, look at textiles and we say, that's so beautiful, or that's so fine, or that's so subtle. You talk about the, actually, let's take a moment to talk about the meaning of the word subtle. I didn't know that until I read your introduction.
Yes, well, it does have, a lot of words that we use have a textile base, and that one certainly does, talking about the fine quality and how that translates for me in both looking at the textiles, but when you look at them, you can see these very subtle, very beautifully made textiles. And those two words just brought together my idea and of how I look at the textiles from Indonesia.
The thing that is, one of the many things that's fascinating about them is that they're not only beautiful, but they also are completely bound up with the spiritual and social practices of the people who make them. And understanding that and decoding it must have been an incredibly interesting journey for you.
It's an ongoing journey. And lots of people have studied it over, you know, the last century or so. But as a field of anthropology, it was something that really got going in the 1960s. And scholars went and lived in various small villages all over Indonesia, of course in Bali, but also much further afield than that. And there was a tremendous amount of research just at this point where Indonesia was really changing and entering the modern world and becoming much more homogenized. So a lot of the local traditions were beginning to end. So we're very fortunate that just at that time, and that was the time my interest began, actually in the 70s, that it was caught. Now, a lot of that has changed to the point where one couldn't go back and do that research anymore. But a lot of it never got really well published. So that's one of the efforts that I made in this book, was to bring together the scholarship that had been done in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and bring it forward into this period and take another look now that we've had perspective on the studies that were done in that time period. And the other thing that was very important to me as an art historian rather than an anthropologist is to bring it out as to look at it, how to look at it as art. And also, one of the first things that I brought to the field of study of it as art history was actually trying to date some of the textiles. And I went to this group of textiles that I collected, and I selected a few that I thought could be really early, much earlier than everybody else had said, because if you have been to Indonesia, you know that it's right on the tropics, that it's raining all the time and very damp, and it's very difficult to preserve something like textiles in that climate. But I knew that some textiles made it through this because they were so highly valued and so highly respected in their culture. So I made some tests, drew some threads out from very, very fine textiles. I sent them off to be radiocarbon dated in Switzerland. And when the report came back, I just couldn't believe it, that some of these textiles were 15th and early 16th century. So that brought it back into a area of looking at it from an art historical point of view rather than an anthropological point of view. So my idea in this book was to bring together those two perspectives.
What are some of the ways that the textiles that you were studying, and it's a vast subject covering, what are there, 17,000 plus islands in the country of Indonesia? It's a vast country. But just some examples of the way textiles are used that's not only decorative but meaningful.
Actually, textiles really aren't decorative in Indonesia. They are very much part of the culture. And most of the textiles in this book are ceremonial textiles. And they function either as clothing for ceremonies or they function as an important hanging or textile that represents specific ideas within the culture that would be used as a metaphor for a ceremony.
What are some examples of that?
Well, one example, let me see, would be a hanging that would have characters from mythological characters and representing them doing good deeds, which the people for whom the ceremony is going to be given would carry forward in their lifetime.
And there are, it's interesting when you look at them, there are some obvious figures and then there are some abstract patterns. Do the abstract patterns also have metaphorical meanings?
Most of them do. But then in some of the areas which are Islamic and have been for the last 400 or 500 years, a lot of that meaning has been lost as they moved into more abstraction. However, one of the aspects of textiles, particularly in areas we call the Indianized areas, that includes Bali, Java, Sumatra, they were originally animist, and then they were Hindu, and then they were Buddhist, and then they were Islam. And if you look at imagery in textiles from these areas, you can basically see this progression. You see aspects of all of those brought together in one design or in the group of textiles used or designs in one textile.
What are some of the elements of the the animist and the Hindu religions that express themselves in the textiles? Like, what are we actually looking at?
Well, for example, in Bali, it's very obvious because you have Hindu characters. But in other areas, you still see abstracted forms of the sculpture that you would see in Hindu times of figures, but much more stylized, and the same with the Buddhist. The animist traditions are there almost more, but again, they've become quite stylized, so it's quite difficult to see them unless they really are more realistic imagery. But they're a symbol of a certain animal, that was an ancestor. For example, in many cultures in Indonesia, the bird is thought of as either an ancestor or an omen bringer from the ancestor. And so the imagery of birds, either very realistic or abstract, is continually seen. That same is true for a crocodile, which you see in many, many, many forms in Indonesian textiles, which is also considered to be an ancestor.
We're talking to Mary Hunt Kallenberg about her book, 5 Centuries of Indonesian Textiles. One of the characteristics of these textiles is you pretty much never know who made it. People don't sign them the way you would an oil painting.
Well, that's very much a tradition that existed throughout the world into the Renaissance. Most of art was made as part of religion. And if you look at early pre-Renaissance paintings that were made for the church, they're not signed either. This is signing an art is something that really came with secularism. And most of the textiles that are made in Indonesia are not secular. They are part of the traditional religion, whichever it may be. But it's also notable that in Indonesia there are two forms of art. One of them is textiles, and they very much, even though they don't use that word, they see it as a form of expression. And that's the female side. And the male side does tend more towards sculpture, not necessarily as standalone sculpture as we think of it, but in the form, for example, of a knife or a tool or sometimes a statue related again to an ancestor or a mythological figure.
Or the entrance of a house.
At the entrance. Carvings in the houses everywhere.
Even the poorest, when I was in Bali a year and a half ago, even the poorest people in the little tiny shacks have beautifully carved guardians.
Yes, always. And other parts of the house are carved and decorated and painted, though some of the painting, of course, has faded away.
So what do we know about the people who make them? Is it mostly women who weave textiles and dye them and so on?
Throughout the world, textiles are either made by men or women, depending on the environment. If it's a profession, it's usually a man. If it's a village or a small community situation, it's usually a woman. And that is the case in Indonesia, except in Java, where men also do batik as well as women. And that's quite frequent.
And in their role as textile maker, are they considered carriers of the spiritual traditions that those textiles represent?
Absolutely. And the finer the quality of workmanship and design that they do, the higher their prestige as relating to the gods and understanding the culture of their area.
What is their training like? How do people learn to do the dyeing and the weaving and the pattern making, all of it?
Usually it's very family oriented. And the lineage goes from mother to daughter. And the daughter usually learns to weave by watching, not by explanation, and usually from her mother. And she weaves the pattern of her mother. And if her mother has come from another village, she may bring in another pattern than, for example, her neighbor who's only 100 feet away. but it's generally passed down that way, and just by watching. Now, that's the pattern, but there are also some families that do only dyeing, or do the tying of the knots for the ikat process. So it depends on into which family you're born, what you exactly you produce.
Traditionally, in some of the, in the textiles that you've been studying, what are the fabrics that have traditionally been used, and what are the dyes, pre-chemical dyes?
Interestingly enough, it's very limited, and so is the technology. And so that's what's so amazing, because everywhere you go in Indonesia, from one village to the next, you can identify something as being different. However, the dyes are very simple. There's basically three colors. One of them is white, or a slight brown, because they grow a brown cotton, and that's a native cotton. And then there are two other dyes, indigo for blue, which has been around for millenniums and seems to have been discovered in many different places, though it's a dye that is not easy to produce, and one does wonder how people figured it out. And then there's red, and most of the red in Indonesia is Morinda citrifolia, which is called Mengkudu in Indonesian. And called madder in English.
And what's that? How is that made?
That's made in a more traditional dye method by actually dipping the fabric into a compound of the root of this plant, which is mashed, mixed with water, and probably alum. But it varies from town to town and from island to island what they use as the acidifier for the dye. So each red is an identifier also of a community, because each community has its own recipe.
And then what fabrics did they use? Was it mostly cotton?
It's cotton in the eastern chain of Indonesia, but in the Indianized areas in Sumatra and Java, Bali, you see silk. Now, they did grow some silk. There is locally produced silk, but silk was also imported first from India and also from China.
Can you tell, when you look at a textile, what it was used for, what the status of the family was that made it, all those kinds of things?
Well, that's what we're hoping to do. But I can't say we do it across the board. But yes, definitely. One, of course, silk is an identifier of a certain prestige. Use of gold, definitely. The more gold, the more money you had to spend, or the more rank you had. And that is also quite closely controlled in some areas. And then also the level of dyeing, the quality of the dyeing. There's one textile in the book which is a very beautiful soft color, and actually that textile would not hold a lot of respect. However, from an aesthetic point of view, it's quite exquisite. So everything contributes to knowledge of its status. And in some areas that has been well identified, in other areas we still work to be done.
What was it like for you? So you get bitten by the bug of Indonesian textiles. Next thing you know, you're in Indonesia. Next thing you know, you're going from place to place, meeting people, staying in villages. What an adventure.
Well, that's why I got into it.
What was it like to get to know people and bring your profession and your study to them and establish dialogues and trust and all of that?
Well, I never spent a lot of time in one area like an anthropologist would, which would mean 2 or 3 years. Really, I was more or less passing through and would spend, you know, a much shorter time, a week or a month or something like that. And my interest was fairly specific. I was interested in learning how they produce the textiles and what I could about the background. And it really was a wonderful experience for me, because I enjoyed sitting with women of the village. And after you got to know them a little, and sometimes it depended on the language, because Indonesian language is a new language. And in the countryside, people, older women who held the information in their heads, didn't always speak Indonesian. So sometimes, of course, I would be working through a translator into a local language. But they would talk about the textile. They would go and they would get these boxes or baskets, and they would bring out their treasures, which were always sort of, to my eye, smashed in. But it wasn't like they were reverently cared for like I would care for my own textiles. However, they were more reverent to them. They had tremendous respect for them because they had these symbols which had been passed down from one generation to the other. And usually they would say, oh, this belonged 4 generations ago or 3 generations ago or 5. They didn't count time in any other way other than the generations. And then they would talk about what they felt about one design or another. What I learned in doing this, however, was that for example, let's say a design that we might call a water buffalo or a very simple image would be a water buffalo in one little village, and then would be a type of star design in another village, and then would be a sort of cross design in another village. So it was very hard to do that. So in a way, the study I was doing was not as so scientific, but it really was relationship oriented. It was trying to get to know these people, get a feeling for their respect and how they related to it in a personal way.
And then it was also your job to purchase these textiles and
right.
and bring them back for exhibition and so on.
Right. That I did for the Los Angeles County Museum of Art when I was head of their textile and costume department. And I did the first exhibition of Indonesian textiles in this country in 1977. It was a long time ago.
Interesting.
I had already started building the collection for the LA County when I was there as curator. And when I decided that I was not going to make this my professional life, I really wanted to travel more, and particularly to Indonesia, I decided as my last exhibition I would do an exhibition catalog of the collection that I had built for the LA County.
So what is involved in developing a kind of connoisseurship of these textiles?
Well, connoisseurship is based on many aspects. I think the first one is looking, and looking really, really hard. And I had the advantage of being able to look at museum collections before I ever went to Indonesia, in Europe. So I already trained my eye. That's the first thing. But frequently we don't do that until we've already made the leap and purchased something. That sort of, I think, puts the hook in. And then, in order to become a connoisseur, you really have to look, you have to know. You need to be able to see what you're looking at in relationship to material which is, we know, is good quality. It's important to know something about the textile. As much as you can read, you develop more depth and you develop more of a relationship with the object.
Now, is that the anthropological part of it to some extent?
It could be, yes. It could be a study of the people. It could be more from an art historical point of view if it's an older piece where you can try to work out the symbolism of this layering of all of these different religions and cultures that have passed through this area. So there are many ways, but I think that's also very important, and that's why the book also emphasizes that. So you have to be able to approach the subject from different points of view. And then the more you look at, and the more you learn, and the more you develop your eye.
Now, you have started this TAI, Textile Arts Gallery, here in Santa Fe. Is it primarily Indonesian textiles?
Yes, it is, but it hasn't always been that way. Because when I was at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and at the Textile Museum in Washington before that, I was head of all textiles, and I loved them all. Can't say totally equally, but you know, I was really attracted to the medium. And so I have been involved with textiles as a dealer from many areas of the world, from Africa, from Peru, from Europe. And actually, I've sort of moved from one area to the other. And because I've been involved with those areas, I've been able to sort of put aside the Indonesian pieces that I love so much for myself.
When people buy textiles, are they in this country, in Santa Fe, are they mostly buying them to hang on the walls as works of art?
People do buy them for that purpose. And our gallery deals with people all over the world, not just in Santa Fe. In fact, I'd say Santa Fe is not a large market for the textiles, but there are collectors everywhere. And interestingly enough, most of the collectors are men. Very few are women. And they don't care about seeing the textile. They're building collections, and most of the textile collectors that I work with seriously have drawers full of textiles or boxes full of textiles, and they know where everything is, and they know what they have, and generally they keep files of them, so that, you know, they have visual access, but they don't need to hang them up.
What is the point of building a collection when you don't look at them?
Well, people who collect prints and drawings and photography is the same thing. Yes, generally they'll have some pieces hanging, and they'll generally rotate them so that they can see the material afresh. But having everything hung just isn't necessary. For a true collector of any field, even people who collect contemporary art, will have a warehouse full of their collection.
Well, and museums themselves, we don't see
exactly
95% of what they have.
Exactly. But you have a memory. I mean, there are a lot of the textiles in my book that I had maybe not seen for a decade or two when I brought them out to be photographed.
Right.
But they were very much in my head. I knew them all. But when I had a chance to take them out again and look at them, it was like Christmas, yeah.
Right. It's a funny thing when you go to places, for example, in Asia, in Indonesia, where people live so differently and the same objects mean such different things to them as they do to us. You are purchasing it as a work of art, as a piece in a museum collection or something to be sold. They have them as generations-long, traditional, family, meaningful, symbolic works. How do you integrate their way of thinking about them into your own?
You can only go so far in doing that. I think, you know, studying them, the scholars who have studied them, is very important. And to know what their research has produced, I think is very good. But can you take something from another culture and can it have the same significance for you? That I don't think that's possible. I think it can have a significance, but it's not going to be the same because you're a different person from a different culture.
Does it make you reflect on the things that you have in your culture that you use and the way they use those things?
Perhaps. I'd actually never thought of it that way, but I do know, even in my own culture, I mean, I know textiles of my own culture very well because I grew up with an interest in embroidery and quilts and things in my family. But there are a lot of people who live in America who have no idea of that.
So this is a book that really is, as we were talking about, the result of many decades of study and travel and collecting and so on, and it's a gorgeous, huge book. What were some of the challenges that you came across in doing it?
It was a huge project. And even though I've done several other books, I did a large book on Navajo textiles early in my career. I didn't understand how big a project it was. Also, because I had a fair number of different contributors, it was a matter of dealing with them, mostly long distance, because they were in Europe. And that led to all sorts of complications. And organizing everything over the basically a three-year period was a phenomenal amount of organizational work that really I wasn't aware of. And the other aspect was that I've done several books in my life, big books, not quite as large as this, and I always worked very directly with a publisher. And I was always unhappy at the end because it wasn't the quality that I wanted. So I promised myself with this book that I would oversee everything, which, quite honestly, is a crazy idea. But I did it. And so I hired very good people to help me. The designer is a superb designer, and so is the woman who did the production work. Lorraine Wild was the designer, and Amy Cooper was the production person. And I'd worked with them on two other books previously for someone else. So, I hired the people who I thought would do the best job, and I oversaw everything.
And you were not disappointed with the result, I'm
hoping.
And
I was not disappointed with the result, but I was exhausted.
Yeah. Who is the book intended for? Is it for other art historians, series collectors, everybody?
For me, it's about spreading the word and sharing the pleasures that I've had in building this collection and being in Indonesia and getting to know the Indonesian world. And I hope the audience is much broader than the people who are already knowledgeable. And I think we're doing a good job at getting the word out about the book. We've had very good PR so far. And I'm happy to say that we've also been included in the New York Times Best 10 Gift category, in our category, which is the antique category. So that will be announced shortly. And so I hope people will buy the book because they want to discover something new.
Mary Hunt Kallenberg is art historian. She's the co-owner of the Thai Textile Arts Gallery here in Santa Fe. She's co-editor of the book 5 Centuries of Indonesian Textiles. And once again, she'll be speaking this Sunday, the 21st of November at 3:30 at the Inn and Spa at Loreto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. It's their Meet the Authors series ongoing. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for a wonderful interview.
And as we go into our next segment, we're going to start with Victor Alvarez and Sabor. They're going to play a song for us here in the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Sandra Mora, que tiene la Sandra Mora que a todas.
Victor Alvarez and Sabor. And the members of the band Sabor are Victor Alvarez, who plays mandolin, and Glenn Harvitz on bass, Fred Simpson on congas, and J.J. Oviedo on hand percussion and bongo. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you guys have a new weekly gig playing Cuban music of this kind. It's every Thursday. That's tonight, Thursday, from 7:30 to 10:30 in the evening. Excellent.
Correct. Yeah, we're very excited about it. This at the Santa Fe Brewing Company, and their sound system there is great, and of course Glenn is helping with the sound there as well.
So you, Glenn, are a sound engineer as well as a bass player.
I am, as well as a producer and a recording engineer.
Now, you, Fred Simpson, African drummer, many people have taken African drumming classes from you. You are getting into Cuban music, Afro-Cuban music as well.
Yes, I am.
Tell us about that transition. What are you learning? What's new? What's different? What's the same?
Well, technically, it's a little bit different, but what it really is a sensibility. You have to learn the songs. You know, my Spanish needs to improve. It's improving.
To sing back up.
I'm singing back up, and there's a format. There's a whole format that goes back to the 20s and the 30s, and it's there's a mixture of course, the African tradition with the drumming, and the mixture of the European influence. So it's learning all of that.
Victor, you've been playing with Sabor for how many years?
I think 10.
10 years, and always in Santa Fe. Tell us about the kind of music. I mean, we've played quite a bit of son on this program, but what is Cuban son?
Well, the Cuban son is a fusion of African music with Spanish music from Spain that was back in the 1800s when the Spaniards were in Cuba and they were having their dances and their where they play the minuet was very famous then and things of that nature. That's what, you know, the long dresses and that kind of stuff. And the slaves that were brought to Cuba were actually brushing their horses outside for the carriages, and they got together with the flamenco players that they brought to play, and so the song came from that. That was the very basic root of the song.
It's funny to think of this type of music as having its origins in things like the minuet.
Right. Well, because from the minuet came the danson. And then from the danson came the song. And then from the song came salsa.
And it was, the, of course, the African percussion that made it all.
Oh, yeah, that's what bound it, yeah.
J.J. Oviedo, you are a bongo hand percussion player. How did you get into this music? Have you been doing it all your life?
No, I'm actually a... I'm actually a taught jazz drummer and drum set player. But I got into this music, I don't know, just kind of out of necessity. I just kind of, I don't know, just started playing it, and it grew on me, and I started kind of exploring it in my own way. And so I've kind of brought some of what I've learned from playing drum set into this context through the hand percussion, bongo, stuff like that. So
I would think, I mean, the people I know who have gone from playing rock and roll drumming, even who are really good, jazz drumming, it's a big learning curve still to internalize those Cuban rhythms.
Oh yeah, it's quite a bit different. My advantage was I grew up listening to a lot of different types of music. My parents were into a lot of different types of music, a lot of bossa nova, a lot of Latin, a lot of the old stuff from the 30s and 40s. So I've had always heard those recordings even before I started playing drum set, and then when I started playing jazz and all that sort of thing, I sort of learned that, and then in the background I had the Latin background, and so in a way it just kind of came forward, you know. So
right. Glenn, what's your own background in Latin music?
Well, that's an interesting question to ask. Actually, my background is very varied. I've been involved in music since 1968 in various different forms. And to me, Latin music is just another way of expressing the shapes that appear within the music. So this is just another way to express myself in a different idiom and try and encompass as many different idioms as I can within this idiom.
What is your own background? What kind of music have you been playing in the past since 1968?
Well, I started learning from the inventors of fusion music. Pat Martino was one of my teachers. Jaco Pastorius was one of my teachers. Maestro Dennis Sandoli out of Philadelphia, the man who taught John Coltrane and many others as well. That's the school that I come from, as well as I'm classically trained, as well as when I was 12, I was in a band with Astor Gilberto's kid, and we used to play locally. And, I realized that there's more to music than just playing. It's more of a way of life, and I've been trying to encompass as many different ways in my life as possible. Thank you for asking.
And what about bass for Latin music? I mean, I remember when I started listening to salsa, and even simple formulaic salsa sometimes had incredible syncopated bass lines.
Right. Well, the syncopations by themselves are actually rather simple. They're shapes. When I got into listening to cachao and cachaito, I realized that you could simplify these shapes even more so. And so you can basically get away with a 3 feel over a 4 or a 6 feel over a 4, or you could even go as far as 7s as long as you repeat it enough in order to be able for it to come back to the least common denominator.
Right.
So it's basically just shapes. It's lines and shapes, and it's a wonderful experience playing it with these guys.
So, Victor, how do you choose the repertoire for Sabor? Is it all absolutely the classic Cuban song? Are you putting other stuff in as well?
Oh, no, we put other stuff in there. A lot of the songs that we do are songs that I used to play as a kid in Cuba. But some of the other songs are what's popular in the Cuban or in the Latin circles, as far as, especially in Cuban music. So a song we also do... some other kinds of Cuban music, but we also do things outside of Cuban music, like merengue. We do
reggaeton on the mandolin.
No. We don't know. We do what is sombras? Yeah, cumbia. We do cumbias, and we do
basically your dance tunes, dance rhythms that people want to dance to.
Well, that's the fun part about us, I think, that we can do a dance situation where people can go and dance to all these styles of music no matter where they're from. However, we can, as we're going to be doing tonight, we can actually play acoustically and play in a more serene situation, quieter, and yet still have fun and not be intrusive kind of thing. And so it's a pretty big... spread there, but I think that's fun because you don't get bored. It's not the same thing all the time for us.
You have a documentary that we've talked about on this show that was made basically about your life as a musician and your return to Cuba, and it was very poignant for me to watch that, because when you leave a country with such an incredibly rich musical tradition and end up in, you know, New Jersey or someplace.
Right, exactly. Well, you
it's
have
rough.
A good memory. Yeah, it's really, it was a mind-boggler.
And how have you been able to really keep alive or reawaken your Cuban roots in your own life?
Well, they never went to sleep. I was at them very present. And in fact, I think that about 30 years ago or so, I was 2 at the time, of course, but about 30 years ago.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I had a big band and I did all Latin music. And what was fun for me at the time, of course, was taking popular American songs and converting them to Latin. But when I moved out here 15 years or so ago, I wanted to do more of the Cuban music that I like. more straight Cuban music. And so I started doing that. I met Jay, and he's been instrumental in helping me accomplish that.
No pun intended.
No. Actually, that was a fraudulent slip.
Well, Victor Alvarez, Glenn Harvitz, Fred Simpson, and J.J. Oviedo are all part of the band Sabor. They're playing at the Santa Fe Brewing Company tonight and every Thursday at 7:30. Are there any other regular places where people can hear your music?
Sure. Let's see. On Wednesdays, we're playing at La Posada from 6:30 to 9:30. And people do dance there. They go there, and we play acoustic, unamplified, but people still dance. And so Thursday, as you mentioned, we're at the Santa Fe Brewing Company. And Saturdays, we're at the San Francisco Street Bar and Grill.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, shall we go out with just a little bit more music?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
I need to say one thing, though.
Yes.
I think for, you know, the regular, say, you know, mainstream American audiences, they need to know one thing about Cuban music. It is one of the greatest musical forms on this planet and far-reaching.
I know.
They play it in Africa. I mean, you can go to Africa, you can hear all the Cuban songs. The Cuban music has influenced Congolese music, which has influenced the rest of the popular music in Africa. So it's so far-reaching.
It's
beautiful, beautiful music.
So. And I think that Fred has excellent taste.
Well, let's hear another song. We just have a minute or two before we go out.
Okay.
Listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.